All right. Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
And Shabbat Shalom to those who will be watching this with us later. I have a message I've been working on since we came back from the U.S., and I didn't really plan on giving it over here. I didn't think I'd give this for another couple of weeks, but I felt inspired by our group to give this today before you leave. And because, like I said, it's going to be a very big change in our congregation coming up later this year. And this is the first sermon, the beginning of this. So I'm calling this the Philadelphia Experiment. The Philadelphia Experiment. I don't know if you've ever heard. There's something called the Philadelphia Experiment back from World War II, where there's a story that goes around that there was a boat that was a Navy boat from the American Navy that was in Philadelphia, and they had this technology that they were able to transport that boat by thought, you know, not to transport it. And I think they even made a movie about it, but it's called the Philadelphia Experiment. This is a different Philadelphia Experiment, but it will be a Philadelphian Experiment. So I thought it was really interesting name to call it, and that's what I called it. Joel 2 and verse 28, I'm going to start there. Joel 2 and verse 28. And it will be afterwards, I will pour out my spirit on all flesh, and your sons and your daughters will prophesy, and your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall see visions. And I've been saying, I'm fully convicted that this started at Shavuot in 2015. I've seen progressively since that time the congregation growing in many different ways that Yahweh has been inspiring, not the least of them being the kibbutz movement starting just a year after that, different healings and miracles that elders have been sending me around the world. But I can clearly see that this has started, you know, that Yahweh is pouring out His Spirit on His people. And if you remember, I gave a message a little while ago called A Message from Yeshua to You. And there's seven messages in Revelation, and if you're part of His congregation, one of those messages is to you, you know. So which one is it? A lot of people afterwards, you know, we've had discussion, people would write me, and, you know, it's almost like when we're looking at spiritual gifts, right? Which one of these to me? Do I have the gift of this, the gift of that? So one of those letters is to you. And today when we're looking at the Philadelphia Experiment, I believe that Yahweh has clearly shown me now the template to be a Philadelphia. It's something I said in those messages that we should be striving for. I know I'd rather be a Philadelphian than any of the other six end time congregations. But you just don't be one. You just don't pick it out. It's not like, you know, going up to a market and saying, okay, give me half a pound of Philadelphia. You know, it doesn't work that way. But yet now that Yahweh is showing the template, which I'm going to show you today, now it'll be really interesting. Because now we really, I don't think I really need to go over it, although I've done in messages on Philadelphia, the template for the Laodicean. I mean, that's a pretty easy template. You could see, although if you're Laodicean, you don't see it because you're blind and think you're rich and increased with goods and need of nothing. You don't know you're blind, you're miserable, poor, and naked. But for these other ones, if you can actually see a template to say, okay, I can see this is what a Philadelphian needs to be doing, and I'm not doing that, then you could evidently see whether you are Philadelphian or not, or you're moving in that direction. So Acts 4 in verse 31. Acts 4 in verse 31. It says, "And they having prayed, the place in which they were gathered was shaking, and they were filled with the Holy Spirit and spoke the word of Elohim with boldness. The assemblies of those men who were believing, but had one soul in one mind, and no man among them concerning the possessions that he possessed would say that they were his. Rather, everything that they had was in common." And like I said, we read this before. There has never been a congregation like this again that we see in history, except for the first century. There's been good congregations. We see the Waldenses in the wilderness, right, for almost 1,000 years. They were faithful. They were martyrs. They gave up their life. They lived in community, but not like this. Not where people had everything in common. Not kibbutz-type style. So this is where Yahweh's moving in the end time. because that's the kingdom mindset. In the kingdom, there's no private property. So if we're having this mindset of possessions and hoarding and mine and yours, you're not going to be in the kingdom. That's not the kingdom mindset. But these people had it. One soul in one mind, meaningly, one life, one goal, one purpose, right? That's Yahweh and Yeshua. They're one in mind, they're one in thought, they're one in purpose. So the Father and the Son never have a different purpose because they're united that way. They're Ikad. And the amazing part for me, like I said, I'm 35 years in this faith, that I see it happening. It's happening now. Just like I said, we were out here on the Sea of Galilee the other day. And I say, if there's ever a place where you could walk on water, it's there. Because not only did Yeshua walk on that very water, but Peter, a man, walked on that water. He literally got out of the boat and walked on the water. So if there's a water you can walk on, that water you can walk on. And it's the same here, you know, that as we're looking at this, you know, we're looking at having one mind, one purpose, one life. That if there was ever a time to do it, it's now, because this is the first time we're seeing it, that it's actually happening. So now you have a template. You're saying, it's not just something we're hoping for. It's not something we've talked about for years that will happen. It's happening. And that's why I said in Shavuot, if it's not happening in your life, you better get on your hands and knees and you better start repenting, because it's happening around the world. That brethren are living this way, their minds are changing, they're surrendering to each other. And to see this happening now, not in one place, like here just Jerusalem, but seeing it happening around the world is special. And it's showing us. And what you see is that people are happy doing this. And it's bringing the spirit of happiness. And then you'll have the Laodicean coming up to you and like, no, this is controlling spirit. No, and then you're like, wow, this guy's miserable and he's telling me how to live? You know? It's becoming evident, the Laodicean and the Philadelphian. But within there's also Sardis and Thyatira and Ephesus and all these other ones. So this is what we're going toward. And with great power, the apostles were testifying of the resurrection of the Master Yeshua, and great grace was upon them all. And there was no man among them who was lacking. For those who had possessed fields and houses would sell them and brought the price of whatever was sold. And this is what we have to work on now. Because not every one of our kibbutzes right now is 100% communal as far as all the things. That's not the mindset everybody's at yet. So this is the end result in the kingdom, but we're all starting somewhere. But how do we work this out then? What do you do then when you have a widow in your congregation? Maybe a young widow, not that old, 50, 60 years old, and they don't have a husband, or they have a divorced husband that's not with them, and they have to survive. How do they pay their rent, right? And maybe the congregation can't pay their rent. They don't have the money. But this is where we got to figure this out, and we got to figure it out now. Because we don't tell that widow, you got to leave. And this is where communal living, this is where the next step that Yahweh is bringing us. And there's a template now that I'm going to show you today that's working. That if we follow this template, we can do it. And that's why I'm excited. Because like I said, I have the gift of administration. And when I look at something, I say, wow, if something's going to work. And again, what is a successful plan? You take something that's working and you try to make it 10% better. We don't have to reinvent the wheel, but we take something that's working, and now we have to modify it into our belief system, into our congregation. So we're seeing these things happening. And there was no man among them who was lacking, for those who had possessed fields and houses would sell them and brought the price of whatever was sold. And they laid them at the feet of the apostles, and it was distributed to each according as any had need. And Yosef, the one surnamed Barnabas by the apostles, which being translated as son of comfort, a Levite, a Cypriot by grace, a field being his, selling it, he brought the proceeds and placed them at the feet of the apostles. And this is why I say the tithe is something. The tithe is holy to Yahweh. The tithe isn't something we decide what we're going to do with it. It's very clear. When you look at the tithe comes to the priest, and the priest distributed the tithe. But there's Laodiceans out there. They want to use their tithe as a weapon. They don't want to give it into the congregation. They want to hold it because they want to decide. And now when they meet nice people, they want to try to use their tithe to entice you. And it's really bad, you know. It's like a form of prostitution, what you're trying to do. So instead of working as a body like this, they want to decide because they don't want to be part of something, and they want to entice you through maybe buying you things or giving you gifts or helping this way. But they don't have that communal mindset. They don't have the kibbutz mindset. They're not of one soul and one mind. They don't have one life that everybody has the same purpose toward the kingdom of Yahweh. And once we have that, we can't be deceived by the outside. Because once you see brethren that are living that way, and somebody coming in that wants to be on the outside, they don't want to be part of it, but they want to entice you, you know, with little, like a dog, with little flabs of meat, you're not going to fall for it. So this is what we see. This is what we see in the first century, and now everything is first circle. Yahweh works in a circle, and now we see it happening. And like I said, we're 3 years into it, and now it's picking up steam, because now Yahweh's really bringing that vision in on what we should be doing and how to do it. So I'm excited about it. And like I said, Yahweh blessed our congregation to start the kibbutz. We started it about 3 years ago. We have, I think, five of them now. We have two or three more starting this year, and quite a bit more. I believe probably in the next 3 years we'll have at least 10 of them, maybe more of them. So it's something that's happening. Communal living, you know, where we see, like in the kibbutz, where we visit some of these, equality to everybody, you know, equal pay, no private ownership. And again, in the kibbutz model here in Israel, which is not the biblical model, there's a lot of things we could learn from it. It's not the biblical model. But it worked because the people coming here were coming from a communistic mindset. Most of the early kibbutz people are coming from Ukraine, they're coming from Russia, they're coming from these areas. And then, of course, with the Holocaust, 6 million Jews being killed, and then a rush of about 500,000 people after World War II ended that lost most of their family. They had nothing, and they migrated to Israel. Wow, kibbutz was a great way because you could just join the kibbutz. You don't need anything. The little you have, you give in, but most of them had nothing. So it was a way they could work together. But since it wasn't built on the biblical model, we see 100 years later now that the model, to a large degree, is falling apart. It's still working on maybe a worldly end. Most of these kibbutzes are making money. The people seem to be happy. But it's not kibbutz anymore. It's not a communal thing as it once was. So it worked at that time because they had a common goal and common needs. But it's not... It was never the model for sanctification. We see that. It was a model for community. And like I said, some good things there that we could look at and say, you know, even how to do laundry, right? 30 bins of laundry. Wow, I would have never thought of that, right? So there's some good things we could look at them and say as a community we could learn. But it was never a model for sanctification. That was not the purpose of the kibbutz. And that's our purpose in the end time. The whole reason for the kibbutz is sanctification. That's the cornerstone. That's the foundation of it. So although we want to look at the kibbutz model, you know, for communal living, we can't look at it for sanctification because it's not a model in the kibbutz. Whether it was Qumran, because Qumran is, again, we see the very first kibbutz was not the Ganya in 1910, but it was Qumran going back in the year 196 BC. 196 BC is when the Essenes moved down to Qumran. It was a community of about 450 people, and that's really the first kibbutz. They had everything in common over there, and it was amazing how that community worked, you know. But the reason why it worked is everybody was committed to the same common idea. So this is the key I read you here. The assembly of those men who were believing had but one soul, one life. We were talking about that yesterday. Our soul is our life. And one mind. One mind, one soul, one purpose. And that's why I work with Qumran. So like I said, I've been studying Qumran for more than 25 years. And I say, I don't believe everything that they believed in. I don't believe all of their eschatology. But what really impresses me about them is it worked. Their community worked. It was there for close to 300 years. The only thing that stopped it was the Romans destroying them. And why? Why could that community stay for 280 years It stayed for 280 years because they believed in the system. Nobody doubted the system. They had a system of justice with elders, right? It wasn't perfect, but they believed in it. And when a judgment came, nobody questioned it. That's it. Okay, I'm looking for justice. I'm coming before. The decision is made, and somebody's got to lose, right? There's two people there. So if I lose, that's fine. If he loses, that's fine. As long as we got justice. We have an avenue for justice. You know, we have an avenue to bring a gripe or to bring a problem before. But the key was they were all committed to the same life, the same purpose. Like I said, modern Zionism is not Torah-based. There's certain things about it that they use the Torah. There's a religious aspect to it. There's even religious kibbutzes. I find it very interesting that what we were told, that there today there are roughly 300 kibbutz. But because most of them are not kibbutz anymore, there's only about 40 that are actual really kibbutz anymore that are communal. The rest of them are just like condominium community, but it's not a kibbutz. But out of those 300, there was about 15 to 20 that were religious, right? So not a whole lot of them. You know, you're looking at less than 10%. But out of the ones that say kibbutz, 10 of those 40 are religious. So most of the religious ones stayed communal because they had the common goal. They had a common belief system. The ones who went the way of the world, the ones who didn't want to live in community anymore, were the ones that had, they did not have the common belief of the Torah. So I found that extremely important as we're looking for the Philadelphian experiment. We're looking how we're going to do this as Philadelphians. So we can learn how the people here on kibbutz, how they live, how they worked, how they ate together. You know, like I said, even how they separate their laundry. But like I said, the movement was never based on sanctification. So we're not going to learn our sanctification from the kibbutz movement. And I believe that's the reason why ultimately it fell apart. Because once the main reason for them to start this community, right, was that everybody was starting with nothing. Once that left, once they started making money and once things were going good, then people wanted private property. They didn't want equal pay. They didn't want the neighbor to know as much as themselves. And then even with food, right? Why don't they eat communal meals anymore? Because people started overtaking the meals. They started taking more food than they can eat and throwing half of it away. They started bringing the food back home. And then the kibbutz couldn't afford to feed them anymore. So what does the kibbutz do? They say, we want to keep community, but we're going to have to charge maybe $1 a meal. And what happens? No one wants to come anymore. What happened to give everything you have and take what you need? It turned the opposite. Take everything I need and only give what they're forcing me to. That's what it came to become. It's human nature. And human nature will always work this way. So without the spirit of Yahweh, this can't work. Real kibbutz can't work. Communal living can't work. What we see in the first century, it can't work without the spirit of Yahweh. And even with the spirit of Yahweh, every day of our life, we have to keep convicting ourselves of why we're there. When there's a problem and something doesn't go my way, maybe I make a suggestion how something should be done, and it isn't done that way. I have to keep telling myself that there's a greater good. This is not about me. It is about the spirit of Yahweh. It's about the community. You have to think in the mindset of a community. You can't be thinking in the mindset of what's best yourself. So now I want to start going into the Philadelphia model. And like I say, if you want to learn to bake, where are you going to go? Bakery, right? You want to learn to bake, you go to a bakery. If you want to learn how to make horseshoes, you go to a blacksmith, right? So if we want to learn how to be a Philadelphian, let's go to the Philadelphian congregation. And I say, I don't know how we missed this. I don't know how I missed it. Because I'm studying it for 30 years and it's been right before my eyes. And somehow I missed it. But that's what you have to do. You have to go to the experts. You have to go to the people that are there that are succeeding at it. And you just model them and make it 10% better. That's all you have to do with anything in life. You know? So again, I want to learn how to bake, I'm going to go to a bakery. I want to learn how to make horseshoes, I'm going to go to a blacksmith. I want to learn how to be a Philadelphian, I'm going to go to the Philadelphians. And it's right in my book. It's right in the book. So I am going to read some things from the book, because let's see who these Philadelphians are. If we're going to go to them, let's see who they are, and let's see what we need to do. So, I'm going to start on page 294. This is chapter 11, From the Gates of Hell Will Not Prevail Against Her by Me. Page 294, I'm going to be skipping around, but I'm going to read the highlights about the Philadelphians, because this is chapter 11, the Philadelphian congregation. It says, we now come to what is mentioned as the Philadelphian era of Yeshua's congregation. Of course, Philadelphia means brotherly love, and this is what this era will be categorized from: explicit outward concern for their neighbors and righteous character exposed in their life. So, wow. Even the fact of it being called the Philadelphia congregation, you know, Philea, you know, the congregation of brotherly love. It's got a great concept. And now when you come here and you're learning about the kibbutz, you see it. You know, that you could put people together with a common goal, but if there's not common love for each other, there's going to be bitterness in everything. People, why is his house bigger than mine? Why didn't I get this? There's always that thing there. But I say, and you're experiencing it, there is no greater joy in life than to be with people of like mind, right? Especially when you go, the first few years we were here in Israel, every day we would meet people that weren't of like mind. We're volunteering in the bookstore in Jerusalem, and we're meeting Christians almost every single day. And Petra can tell you, it was torture sometimes, because they're coming in, and the law is nailed to the cross, and da-da-da-da-da, and I'm under grace. And every day I'd be there fighting the fight. And then finally I went to the manager of the store, and I said, look, if you want us to leave, I'll leave, but I'm not going to sit here and let people degrade the Torah. And the man who was a Messianic Jew became a very good friend of ours who was the manager. He said, no. He said, I like what you're doing. And when we went into that bookstore, everybody in that bookstore were Messianic Jews that were not keeping the Torah, were not keeping Sabbath. They were like Christians, and they're real Jews. Within maybe a year, maybe less, every single one of them came to Sabbath belief, Torah belief. They even asked me to go to the Messianic congregations there and teach the importance of the Torah. And they became our best friends. They became like our family there, even till today. You know, we still have contact with these people. So, there is no greater joy that Yahweh gets when his people are dwelling together in unity, right? Psalm 133. How blessed and how good it is for Yahweh's people to dwell in unity. And you don't see it today around the world. I'm telling you, I visit many, many congregations. I'm blessed to speak in many congregations. I love everybody of Yahweh, but I can tell you this with all assurity that I do not see in any congregation except Congregation of Yahweh Jerusalem this spirit of Ikkad that's coming. And I'm not saying we have it completely. We have our problems too. But I see it in our congregation, and I see it growing. I see it growing. I see people wanting to come together, wanting to live together, wanting to have common goals together. And it's a beautiful thing when you see it happening, you know, because it makes us feel happy in life, secure in life, that you have real friends. You have people that love you above everything. And they're not just going to walk away. They're going to stand there with you because they're part of your life and they're part of the congregation. And we're all standing for the same thing because of Yahweh, you know? One mind, one strength, and how beautiful it is. And as we come more into our modern day and a very important part of the history of the two congregations of Yeshua, I want to once again give a few more quotes to continue conclusively to prove that the branch of true believers coming to America, being called Anabaptists, Seventh-day Baptists, Mennonites, Puritans, and even some Quakers, were indeed the remnant of the earlier true congregation called by its enemies, mainly Paulicians and Waldenses. So again, there's much, much history that shows that these Waldenses, first they were called Paulicians, and then they're called Waldenses, who were also many names they gave them, in Sabbatai, Katharai, there's many names they give them. But from around the year 6700 AD, all the way to the Protestant Reformation, the main branch of Yahweh's true congregation that continued were some form of these Waldenses, which comes from Switzerland, the word valley dwellers, Valdo, Waldenses. And what I'm going to show here is that these Waldenses who started to be called by other names after, you know, Anabaptists, Mennonites, Amish, the other ones. They are part of the true congregation of Yeshua who come, they are the Philadelphians. The Philadelphian era that comes to America are these people, starting with the Pilgrims. You know, the Pilgrims in 1620, about half of the Pilgrims were part of the true congregation of Yeshua. It says, the origin of the sect, who from their repetition of baptism received in other communities, are called Anabaptists, but who are also denominated Mennonites. And we know the Amish came out of the Mennonites. The Amish came out in the late 1600s because they felt the Mennonites were starting to get too worldly and starting to take some of the worldly things. So the Amish, under a man by the name of Jacob Ammon, he said, no, we need to keep the rigidness. We need to keep the sanctity. We need sanctification, and they separate. But Amish and Mennonite are basically the same people who are Anabaptists. Even today, when you meet the Amish and the Mennonite, they'll tell you, no, no, we are the Anabaptists. What does that mean? It means that as the Protestant Reformation was coming under Martin Luther, they would not allow people that were either Protestant or Catholic that were coming into the true church to join the congregation unless they were rebaptized. And that's why originally they're called anti-Baptists, meaning in the place of baptism. They would not accept the Catholic baptism or the Protestant baptism because they did not have authority, those men, to do the laying on of hands. So the people started calling them Anabaptists. And today, when you go, again, if you visit Amish or Mennonite groups, they'll tell you that. We are the Anabaptists. And even today, if you come from another group and you've joined the Amish or joined the Mennonite, you must be rebaptized because you have to have a proper baptism. The same as we have. You know, that if you're baptized by some guy in the world who has no authority to baptize you, that doesn't mean anything. You must be baptized in the proper line that is never stopped. It's there from Yeshua laying hands on the apostles, who laid hands on others, who laid hands on others, who laid hands on others, right? And somebody in that line laid hands on the Mennonites and the Amish. You know, they might have went another way from there, but they laid hands on the Seventh-day Baptists and then the Church of God Seventh-day, and somebody laid hands on me, and I laid hands on others. And that original line of succession from Yeshua has never stopped. And we have proof of it, as we're going to see. Even when the Protestant Reformation was starting in 1521, these people had papers that they claim go all the way back to the first century, proving that there has always been a succession of congregations. And it's not hard to believe it because Yeshua said it. The gates of hell will never prevail against my congregation. So he's the one that said it. He made sure there would always be a succession of congregation. So here it says, the original sect, who called Anabaptists, but also are denominated Mennonites. The modern Mennonites affirm that they're predecessors were the descendants of the Waldenses. I'm not going to go into all of this here, but I have so much dogmatic proof that the Mennonites and those people who came over, those original Anabaptists in America, they definitely were from the Waldenses. There's no doubt about it. We have, from that time period, quote after quote after quote that shares this. The attitude of the two bodies toward the question of graveyards, the use of worship of certain forms of prayers, the singing of the same hymns, of observing Yeshua's supper, the principles in congregational buildings, the gray dress of the apostles, the itinerant preachers in the form of asking a blessing, and many other details mark the Waldenses and the Anabaptists of the same origin. It is most clear that the Anabaptists were indeed the continuation of the true congregation of Yeshua that started in 30 AD and continued into that time period as well as today. They even had a letter professing that they were a link in a chain to a progressive continuation of the one congregation of Yeshua from the time of the apostles. And here's the quote. The Baptists of the Reformation claimed they had an ancient origin. Arid went so far as to suggest a succession of congregations. This claim was put forth by them at the very beginning of the Reformation in 1521 AD. An old letter is in existence, founding. It's called Successio Ante Baptistica. The letter bears its own date as that of the Swiss Brethren, written to the Netherlands Anabaptists, respecting their origin a year before Anno 1522. The letter is particularly important since it shows that the Baptists, as early as 1521, claimed a succession of congregations. The author of the Successio Antihastisca of the Antibaptists says, I am dealing with the Mennonites, or Anabaptists, who pride themselves as having the apostolic succession. That is the mission of the extraction from the apostles. And even today, when you go to these groups, they'll tell you this. They feel that they are part of the original congregation. This was one of the main reasons that their detractors were calling them Anabaptists, as since the Protestant Reformation was now here, and many Protestants were joining the true congregation of Yeshua, they were not allowed to join the congregation without having true repentance and being re-baptized by the proper ordained elders, who had the authority to do so with the laying on of hands through the unbroken chain of succession coming from Yeshua and the apostles. Anabaptist was a slang of the original anti-Baptist, and anti means in the place of, as a new convert had to be rebaptized in the place of the false baptism, which would not have given them the Holy Spirit of Yahweh, as we have shown earlier in the book. Only a proper ordained elder has the authority to lay the hands and transfer the Holy Spirit during baptism. The fact that they had an official letter in 1521 stating their succession from the apostles is quite convincing of their claim of an original chain of ordination all the way back to the apostles. The Mennonites are descended from the tolerably pure evangelical Waldenses, who were driven by persecution into various countries, and who during the latter part of the 12th century fled into Flanders and into the provinces of Holland and Zeeland, where they lived simple and exemplary lives in the villages as farmers and the towns by trade, free from the charge of any gross immoralities, and professing the most pure and simple principles, which they exemplify in holy conversation. They were therefore in existence long before the Reformed Church of the Netherlands. We now have seen that the Baptists, who were formerly called Anabaptists, and in later times Mennonites, were the original Waldenses, and who have long in the history of the congregation received the honor of that origin. On this account, the Baptists may be considered as the only Christian society which has stood since the days of the apostles. So, wow, you know, and it's interesting because when you read about the Waldenses and you see the Waldenses kept simple dress, the Waldenses stayed sanctified, the Waldenses were very modest people, and we were blessed. We went to a 15th century Waldenses congregational building. And the first thing that hit us was no pictures on the walls. Very, very modest building, no pictures on the walls. And today, these Mennonites, these Amish, they're still here today. So they're not in a history book just 400 years ago. These people, for 400 years now, from this time, the original Philadelphians are alive today, still living this way. Now granted, they lost some things. They decided this time, because of pressure with the Sabbath, they gave it up. Even the Waldenses did. The Waldenses decided with the Protestant Reformation, because there was so much pressure that the Sabbath was too Jewish, and a lot of them went to Sunday keeping. There was the remnant that kept it. The remnant that came over, these Mennonites, they were Sabbath keepers. They were not Sunday keepers. And I would love if Yahweh would open up the door for me to have a conference with these leaders of the Amish and the Mennonites. I would love to just have an hour with them and share with them their history. I was blessed to do it with the Waldenses, and they agreed with me. They knew it. They knew that this was their history. And they said it's even a conflict today among them because they've given up on a lot of those things. But at the same rate, as we're looking toward now, this idea of community, this idea of living in community, like I said, the kibbutz is only going to take us so far. The kibbutz, we can go out here today. We did it the other day. We can physically go see how they're living because we never did it before and say, that makes sense. This is how they cook. This is how they do this. This is how they lend cars. This is how they do laundry. But you will never find sanctification among them because that was not their purpose. So if we want to learn to bake, we go to a bakery. You want to learn to be a Philadelphian, you go to the Philadelphians, and they're there. They're there. They're living this way, and it's worked for 400 years. It's worked. Something's got to be done right. A couple more quotes, and then we'll move on. According to Pilith Dophorius, the Waldenses themselves carried up the date of their commencement as a body as high as 300 years after Constantine to about the year 637. For my own part, I believe their antiquity to even have been higher. I agree with some of the oldest and best Protestant divines in considering the Albigenses, another name for Waldenses, or Waldenses, for they were in fact one of the same, to have been a branch of that visible congregation against which the gates of hell could never totally prevail, and that the uninterpreted succession of apostolic doctrine continued with them from the primitive times right down to the Reformation. Of the Baptists or Anabaptists, it may be said that they were not reformers. These people, comprising bodies of Christian believers known under various names in different countries, are entirely distinct and independent of the Roman and Greek churches, and have an unbroken continuity of existence from apostolic days down through the centuries. And one more quote here. It is important to mention here that, of course, not every pilgrim or early settler in America was a Sabbath keeper and part of the true congregation of Yeshua. There is definitely a mix of Protestants who also came over to the New World looking for the same freedom as the congregation of Yeshua. However, when you look at the movement of groups that came out of the 16 and 1700s, such as the Mennonites, the Amish, and the Quakers, it is evidently clear from the evidence and historical records that we have shown that the origin of these groups were from the true congregation of Sabbath-keeping believers. So that's powerful, because in my mind, you know, when we were in America, the 2 days before we left, we had the blessing of going down and meeting these people. And wow, it was like cold water in the face to see these people, to see them living in community, to see them even in Babylon. They're set apart, and they're not part of the community. It was life-changing. It was life-changing. I'm saying to myself, this is what we're missing. We're missing something here. We need to go to these people, and we need to understand what's going on. Because, like I said, these people are different than the kibbutz, that they're not only living communal, they're living sanctified lives. And again, I don't know why they acquiesce to go to Sunday keeping. I do know why the Seventh-day Baptists, how that came in, but why they did it. There was a big movement in the 1800s pushing, this is where evolution came from, and some of them, you know, went along with it. But one thing is certain, that the sanctification that we see coming all the way from the Waldenses, of staying separate from the world and not allowing all the things of the world to affect their lives and their families, they kept for 400 years, and like I said, it's working. It's working 100%. The Amish and the Mennonite groups differ from the kibbutz. They have a sanctified life away from technology, worldliness, worldly education, anything dealing with politics, and they've kept family values for more than 400 years. And like I said, I keep saying to myself, how could I have missed this? How could I have missed it? But you know, I look back at my life, and one of the best blessings I have in my life, when I was training to be an elder, and I was a young man in my 20s, I used to go out with one of the other Church of God elders, and we would go and we would visit widows. And I loved it. You know, the widows are thinking you're coming and checking on them. Oh, thank you for coming. I'm like, no, you're doing me a favor. I'm a man in my 20s, and I'm meeting women that were born in the 1800s. And on their walls is pictures of their husband and this, and they're sharing their life. And you're hearing, and then they're telling about their grandmother, who was born before Abraham Lincoln was killed. And it's like, wow, to get that firsthand, I'm so appreciative, because I know now, in the year 2018, there's nobody alive that was born in the 1800s. So now, they're only memories, but boy, am I glad I have those memories. And as a child, I used to like to go with my grandmother. She was born right at the turn of the century. My grandfather was born in 1892. And I used to love to go and talk to her, because the same thing, it's helped my mindset and where I am today. But when we met these Amish people, it hit me. I'm literally talking to people that are born in the 18 and 1700s. The one man said to us, he gave us a ride in his horse and buggy. And the man said, he said, I've never driven a car my whole life. He said, I wouldn't even know what to do to it. He said, I would talk to it, because he talks to his horse. He said, that's what I would do. I wouldn't know anything else. And you're thinking, you're talking to somebody who is pure. Somebody, here it is, we're trying to share, and I'm trying to share with people the modern dangers of social media and internet and television and movies. And here you're meeting people that have never, ever once acquiesced to that. They have never watched a movie. They have never watched television. They have never seen a cell phone. You know, some of them have phone booths outside the house. They don't want it on their property, so it's across the street. So if they have to make a phone call in an emergency, but in their house, there's no electricity. They said, because if we have electricity, we're letting the outside world in. Now, this is back in the 1700s. They're already thinking about that. This is before all the things that we're dealing with today. And now where are we? We're at a point where these things are affecting our lives. They're affecting the congregation. They're affecting everybody. And we're seeing it's getting more and more evil every single day. Every day the internet wants to indoctrinate people into the new world order. And this is why we need to start making decisions as a congregation. And we're like, wow, we have a template. And you know what? I can't argue with it, because it's working. I look at the kibbutz here in Israel, right? It's working to a degree, but it's not working in sanctification. And we ask them, well, how about your children? How many of the second generation stay in the kibbutz? At best, 25%. At best, 1 out of 4. I talk to the Amish. How many of your children stay in the Amish community? 80 to 90%. Because they're sanctified, because they're homeschooling. And I said to the man, I said, how on earth do you keep? I said, you know, in our congregations, I'm trying to share with the youth, you know, with these iPods and cell phones. And I said, how do you keep your children from not wanting these things? And he said, Proverbs 22:6. Proverbs 22:6. Train the child at the opening of the way, and even when he will old, he will not turn aside from it. He said, our children don't want those things. They see how evil the world is. They don't desire it whatsoever. They've been trained from youth, and they're convicted. That's the purpose. I can't sit here and try to convince people to get off the internet if you're not convicted to how evil the internet is. Right? You know, it's like me sitting here trying to tell you, don't lie, don't be liars. I don't have to convince you. Why? Because you're convicted that lying is sin and lying is evil. And you've got to get the same conviction against things like the internet. That it's not something of Yahweh, it's something that's wicked. Because you know what? A good thing can come from a lie. You know, if somebody comes in and you were there in Nazi Germany, right? And they said, we're looking for the Jewish person. And you lie and say, no, there's no Jew here. When he's hiding in your closet. Not always something bad comes from a lie, right? In the end it will. But you can. But yet all of us still say, no, no, we never lie. There's never a reason to lie. Because it's part of Yahweh's character. And it's instilled in us that we never, ever would lie. The same with the Sabbath, right? There's people out there that say, well, you know, yeah, they believe in the Sabbath, but they don't keep the Sabbath. They keep it if it's convenient. But if I have to work, you know, Yahweh will understand that. No, he doesn't. It's a commandment that brings death penalty, capital punishment for breaking the Sabbath. We are blessed that Yahweh has opened our minds to understand Sunset Friday every week we get to enter his rest. We get to enter a form of the millennium. Our mind gets to leave and we get to enter his rest, and we understand it. And if you do, you'll never get shaken with it. I know there ain't a person on this world that can ever convince me to break the Sabbath for any reason. Of course, unless it's life and death. The guy's house is on fire behind us. You know, we're going to go there and we're going to help them. But I would never work on the Sabbath. I wouldn't break the Sabbath because it's part of my character. And we have to start getting the same things. And that's why the Amish, they're doing the same thing 400 years. Why aren't they? Why aren't they evolving to get iPods and internet and all these things? It sure would make their life easier in a lot of ways. Because they are so convicted as a people, and they see that their way worked, that there's no way. You're wasting your breath to try to tell them these things. You will never, ever get them to change that way, because they see their lifestyle is of Yahweh, and they have scriptures. You start asking them, they're going to give you scripture on why they're doing something a certain way. And they believe it. They're convicted in it. And we have to get that same conviction, because that is the model. That's the It's not an analogy. They are the Philadelphians. Now, granted, if I was ever had the blessing of giving a sermon to them, I would share with them on why they lost their baton. That, you know, because they gave up the Sabbath and they gave up the holy days. You know, you lost your baton, yet at the same rate, because they kept their sanctification, Yahweh still blesses them. And they remind me of the modern day Rechabites, right? Let's go to Jeremiah 35. Jeremiah 35. They're like the modern day Rechabites. It's a real interesting story here, because it shows you how much following leadership, following family leadership, following our fathers and grandfathers, as long as they're doing the right thing, how much it helps. But Jeremiah 35, 1 through 2 says, "And the word which was to Jeremiah from Yahweh in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, saying, Go to the house of the Rechabites, and speak to them, and bring them to the house of Yahweh, into one of the rooms, and give them wine to drink." So here it is with these people. They were Kenites, who come from the Moabites, from Jethro, right? So they're not Israelites, and yet they helped Israel, so Yahweh blesses them. And now he tells them, go there and tell these people to drink wine. There's only one problem. Their forefathers told them, don't drink wine. And even though it's not restricted in the Bible, there's no way. My father told me this, and his father told him that. There's no way you're going to get me to go against my forefathers. Well, if we can instill that one thing in our children, how much would the world change? That our children, even if we're not there, that they would never, ever change because they saw our character and they knew that their parents and their grandparents were right. How much more? So let's see what happens here. Verse 5. "And I set bowls and cups of wine before the sons of the house of the Rechabites. And I said to them, drink wine. And they said, we will not drink wine. For Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, commanded us, saying, you shall not drink wine, you nor your sons forever. And you shall not build a house, nor sow seed, nor plant a vineyard, nor shall there be anything to you. But all your days you shall live in tents, so that you may live many days on the face of the land where you are residing. And we have obeyed the voice of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, our father, to all he commanded us, to drink no wine all our days, we, our wives, our sons, and our daughters, nor to build houses for us or in our dwellings, nor that we have a vineyard or field or seed. But we live in tents, and we have obeyed and done according to all that Jonadab, our father, commanded us." Wow. What an awesome thing. Drop down to verse 12. "Then the word of Yahweh was to Jeremiah, saying, So says Yahweh of hosts, the Elohim of Israel, Go and tell the men of Judah and the people of Jerusalem, Will you not receive instruction to listen to my words, says Yahweh? The words of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, are done, in which he commanded his sons not to drink wine. And to this day they do not drink, but obey their father's command. But I have spoken to you, rising up early and speaking, and you did not listen to me. I have also sent you all my servants, the prophets, rising up early and sending and saying, Each man now turn from his evil way, and amend your doings, and do not go after other gods to serve them. And you will live in the land that I have given to your fathers, but you have not bowed your ear to listen to me." And I'm going to show you some scriptures today that there's things that the Amish and the Mennonites have been doing for 400 years that we're commanded to do and we're not doing. And I feel that Yahweh in this verse is not just talking to the sons of Israel. He's talking to us. He's saying the same things. Look at the Amish. Look at the Mennonites. They're listening to Jacob Amon, right? He told them to do these things 400 years ago, and they're doing them to these days. And I've called you to do things. Love not the world or the things of the world, or the love of the Father is not in you. And we can say it over and over again. And yet, our people are still loving the world, working in the world, being part of the world. We're not separated. We're not separated. And now it's coming to the very end, where now Yahweh's saying, you know what? I've told you these things over and over and over. Now each of us is going to reap what we sow. I'm moving in this direction. I am separating. I'm parting the Red Sea. I'm making kibbutzes. I'm instilling in my people this community life. You either come or you stay behind. We have free will. It's a choice each of us are going to have to make. But that's where Yahweh is moving. That's where his congregations are moving. That's the end time wilderness. And it'll be our choice. We have each other. We have Yahweh. And it's working. The same as it's working with the Amish, it's working in our congregation for the people that are doing it. Now it's our choice. Where are we going to go from here? Do we stay in the world and bring this Laodicean mindset of thinking that everything is great simply because I keep the Sabbath and I don't eat pork and I keep the feast days? Or are we ready to move to where Yahweh wants to bring us? Are we ready to really lose ourselves, love our neighbors ourselves, be ready to give anything I have that someone needs more than me, take it? I want you to have it because you need it more than me. And we see it already. We're seeing the results that it's working. That it's working for that. He says, because the sons of Jonadab, the son of Rechab, had stood on the command of their fathers, which he gave them, but this people has not listened to me. So Yahweh Elohim of hosts, the Elohim of Israel, says this, behold, I will bring on Judah and all the people of Jerusalem all the evil that I have spoken against them, because I have spoken to them, but they did not listen. Yea, I have called to them, but they did not answer. And Jeremiah said to the house of the Rechabites, so says Yahweh of hosts, the Elohim of Israel, because you have obeyed your father Jonadab's command and have kept all his commands and have done according to all that he's commanded you. So Yahweh of hosts, the Elohim of Israel, says this, Jonadab, the son of Rechab, shall not have a man cut off from standing before me all those days. And I look and I say, that's why I believe these Mennonites and these Amish are blessed. Because Yahweh is honoring the fact that he's not honoring the fact that they gave up the Sabbath, they gave up some of these things. He's honoring the fact that even after they lost their baton from being part of the true congregation, they kept their sanctification and never changed. They kept their sanctification and never changed. And it's something that Yahweh is honoring. He's honoring their commitment. 400 years, the way it's worked is because they're convicted, and that's why I say that if, as a people, if we are going to move to real sanctification, we got to get convicted. We got to realize that this is where Yahweh is moving, and that we need to change, and we have to be convicted. I asked one of the older Amish men, I said, how for 400 years have you kept these things? And he said, because it's alive. He said, because it's alive. And you hear his voice, the zeal in his voice, And like I said, you look there, they're not faking it. Because they're not trying to prove anything to anybody. They're away. They're not commercially looking for us or anybody else in the world. They're not commercially trying to prove anything to anybody. They're trying to stay out of it. But you look at these people, and they're happy. You look at their women, they're happy. They're Proverbs 31 women. They work, they do businesses, they homeschool their kids, they're doing all this stuff. And you know what? They're happy being women. And the men are happy being men. They're happy going out to their fields, working the farm. They have dairies. And they sell their milk to things like Land O'Lakes, big companies. And why do they want that? Because everything that the Amish and the Mennonite do, they do good. Their furniture, their milk, their cattle, you name it. You get something from them, you're getting the best quality you can get. And they're not suffering. They're very, very wealthy. They're being blessed because they're working. They're working. And you know what? They're doing it all without electricity, right? So sometimes you think, well, how can you do it? How can you build furniture without a power tool? They do use gas. They have natural gas, which is interesting. But, wow, it's working for them. And like I said, Yahweh is blessing them. This is the other thing I looked at that really impressed me. That I look at our congregations, particularly in Babylon, and the congregation has diminished, right? It went from years ago, 100,000 people or more in the congregation there to now, just a remnant, a small remnant, virtually no people. You look at the kibbutz movement here, right? And it almost fell apart. It's shrinking because of the children. And then I looked at the Amish, and I said to them, how many people you have here? And this is only Lancaster. This is only one group, because they have Amish in Ohio. They have them in Wisconsin. And they said, we have 37,000 right now in this community, and within 20 years, it will double. Wow, 20 years, they're going to double to 70,000. That's the size of counties, maybe even a state. And the other thing that was interesting was they said in 400 years, there's only about 50 people that have joined the Amish community. So they're not doing a lot of evangelizing outside, which I'm not saying that's right. We should be doing evangelizing outside. But they're growing from within. They're not losing their children. 80 to 90% of the children are embracing this way of life. And like the guy I talked to, you know, this old man, right? He wasn't there 400 years ago when they started. He wasn't that old, although he was old with white hair and white beard. But he's a child of a guy from 67 years ago, who was a child of a guy from 67 years ago, who was a child from a guy going all the way back to 1620, 1650, right? So what does it show you? That the children are embracing the fathers like the Rechabites, and they're not getting more worldly. It's not being watered down. That their belief system and their conviction of staying away from the world is only growing stronger, and Yahweh is blessing it. Because there's no greater blessing you can have in the congregation than keeping our children in the faith. And that's why last year was the year of the family. I did a lot of messages on it, and it's working. We're seeing, as we have very, very rigid standards now for single men and single women, you know, young youth, as far as courting, not dating, as far as not giving them situations where they're alone together, where bad things can happen, and we're setting up the structure for them, and it's working. And now, I take no greater blessing in my life than when I look at people that were in this school just a couple of years ago, and now I see them married with kids, and I cry when I see it, because they are the next generation, and they're doing it, and they're living it, and they're making sure their kids are going to be that way, sanctified. And yet, I'm telling you, it wasn't easy, because years ago, when Yahweh showed divorce and remarriage is not his will, he hates divorce. This is not something you can allow in the congregation. I got attacked and attacked and attacked over and over again. But I stood my ground. There was no way I was going to change, because I knew this is the word of Yahweh. And now today, as you see these youth, that some of them were just teenagers at that time, they're getting married, they're having families, they're having strong families. And some of their children will be the first ones to go into the kingdom. And we see it working. And that's what we need to do now. We need to be that next generation. Like the Amish and the Mennonites, as far as sanctification, not like them in doctrine, you know. But had some very interesting conversations with some of them in there. The one man was really interesting when he found out I'm a pastor from Israel. And I even said to him, I said, you know, have you ever heard of the name Yahweh? He said, no. What's that name? I said, well, that's the Hebrew name for Elohim. You know, he was using G-O-D, God. And he was like, wow, really? Like a child, wow. You know, he learned something that day. I don't know if he'll continue to use it, but it's like a childlike attitude. But it is so neat to talk to people that are not corrupted by the world. And the Amish, on average, are still having 7 to 12 children, you know. So they have big families. And like I said, they're not hurting. They're not people that are hurting, because Yahweh is blessing their efforts, and they're not money-oriented. They're kind. Even a situation happened in Lancaster a few years ago. A very disturbed man came into one of their schools and killed, I believe it was 6 girls, Amish girls. And it was traumatic. Can you imagine young girls that are killed? They forgave the man. They forgave his family, who still lives in that community there. And even when they got teams of people together, teams of Amish could go and support the families that were killed, they sent the team to this man's house, killed them. And that's the kind of love. I don't see an ounce of animosity, gossip, hatred. And they're looking at us as non-believers. They weren't looking at me as anything, because I'm not an Amish. And yet their kindness and their love is such an example. And that's what I say. Their lifestyle, apart from the doctrine, is working because they're convicted. And so many things now that we're going to have to work on, right? You become a believer. What's the hardest thing? Getting things out of this mind that were there before you became a believer. You know, things you were into, things you thought, bad things that you might have done. And it's very hard, because it's 10 times harder to get something out of your mind than to put it in. And to see people that never put those things in their mind, these people that live the life of purity, and all they want is just to be separate because they believe that's the will of Yahweh in their life. And it's working. And that's why I say, it's the model. You want to be a Philadelphian? Go to the Philadelphians. Look at how they're doing it, and let's see how it's working. You know, there's a story I heard one time, and it was about a Amish community, and an Amish family that was living, and all of a sudden someone moved there. Because believe it or not, it's not like you pass a sign that says Amish town, and now everybody is Amish. They live among people that aren't Amish. You know, as he's traveling this in the buggy, he'll tell us, see that house there? That house has electricity. They're not Amish. This person here, he's a Mennonite. This person is an Amish. So they don't buy a city and then only let Amish into it. So there's people that live there that are not Amish. And it's a really interesting story because it says the Amish family is sitting on their porch and they're watching this family come in from California, and they're having all this stuff, you know, and the children are watching, and they're bringing in the televisions, and they're bringing in the air conditioners, and they're bringing in all of these electronic things, and all these gadgets, you know, and all these games, and they're just watching and looking, and then all of a sudden, after they finished bringing everything in, their refrigerators, and their washing machines, and all of these fancy gadgets that they had, the Amish man walks over to the new neighbor, and he says, I just want to let you know, I saw all of these wonderful things you were bringing in there. If they ever break, if you ever have a problem, you know, come to me, I'll help you. The man kind of looked, he said, I thought you were Amish. He said, I didn't think that you knew how to fix these things. He said, oh no, I'm not going to fix them. I'll teach you how to live without them. And it stuck with me. For 30 years, I heard that story. Because that's what we need now. We need someone to teach us how to live without them, you know? And we lived. The internet is not something that's 100 years old. 20 years ago, we lived without it. You know what? Life was pretty good. I remember as a child going out and playing with friends. Actually, in the summer, I'd go out from 7 in the morning till 7 at night till my mother's screaming down the street, come on, it's dinner time. And actually playing with people. And not just being signed on video games and all this stuff. We had someone who's like a second cousin to us, and when we were visiting a couple of years ago, this boy was there at this video game, and they're trying to talk to him. He's about maybe 8, 9 years old, and he's not answering. He's just like hypnotized. And then the mother laughed and said, oh, he could do that all day for 7 hours. And I'm thinking, oh my, wow, how horrible is that? You know, what are you breeding here? But speaking to these people, seeing their peace and humility, you can't fake that. You can't fake happiness. You can't fake joy. It was really amazing. And like I said, to see how they keep their children in the faith because they keep them away from the world. They keep them away from the world. They're instilling it from birth. Like I said, kind people, they don't gossip. The women, working, compassionate community. And they haven't been corrupted. And the thing is, if it wasn't a reality, I would tell you that could never happen in Babylon. Like, if we went and met these people in New Zealand, I would be the first one to say, there's no way, because environment is 90% of your battle. I'd say, it can't happen in Babylon, and it's happening in Babylon. And that was another thing that showed me something. That if you're convicted of something, if you're convicted of it, and you sanctify yourself, you could do it anywhere. You could do it in America, Europe, Israel. You could do it anywhere in the world. It might be harder, but you can do it. Because they only live in America and some in Canada. There's a few small groups still in Europe. But most of these communities are in the United States. And I say, wow, if it can work in Babylon, it can work anywhere. So that was encouraging to me. And I hope encouraging to our people there. That we see that we can't use those excuses, you know, that it's even working over there. They have no temptation because they have fully chosen completely to refrain from it. They don't have temptation because they completely chosen to refrain from it. How powerful is that in our life, right? When we're trying to be overcomers. It's very easy. Don't put it before you. And then you don't have to worry about overcoming. I've said it for years when I talked about repentance. You know, the place to repent isn't at the end of the bar stool. It's too late by that time. That you have to put these fences around your life so that these kind of things that Satan can't try to attack you. And these people have put a big fence. They put a wall. You know, they put the wall of China there around their life. And there's no way Satan is getting into their life when it comes to community. They're just not. It's just that simple. And this is the Philadelphia model, and they were the actual Philadelphians. That's the people. So, yes, they lost some things, but as far as if we're trying to think in 1620 and 1617, how did those Philadelphians, our brothers and sisters, live? Go and visit the Amish for a day and you'll see it. They're living the same way. Even for the fact of still not even having electricity. Which I'm not saying necessarily has to be the way to go, but I'm saying they have not changed in their sanctification in 400 years. So we don't have to go far to find the model, because the model is there. They are the original Philadelphians. They are the model of sanctification. And like I said, if we're going to learn to bake, we go to the bakers. If we're going to learn sanctification, we need to go to the Amish and the Mennonite. And we must be sanctified to be in the kingdom. In the remaining time I have, I just want to go over some scriptures here that are commandments to us. Some of the things that these people are doing are actually commandments to us, so we need to take this serious. 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 25. 1 Corinthians 1 and verse 25 says, "Because the foolish thing of Elohim is wiser than men, and the weak thing of Elohim is stronger than men. For consider your own calling, brethren, that there are not many wise according to worldly things, not many mighty, not many of noble birth. But Elohim chose the foolish ones of the world, that the wise might be put to shame. And Elohim chose the weak ones of the world, so that he might put to shame the strong things," right? Many people would say the Amish are weak. People go there because they're like freaks to them. They want to go and look at these freaky people, right? That are riding a horse and buggy and wearing a cap. No, they're not freaks. They're not freaks. They're the people that are living the sanctified life. "And Yahweh has chosen those of humble families in the world, and the lowly, and them that are insignificant, in order to belittle them who think themselves important, so that no flesh might boast in his presence, but you also belong to him through Yeshua Messiah, who was made to us wisdom from Elohim, both righteousness and sanctification and redemption, so that even it has been written, he that glories, let him glory in Yahweh." You know, a few years ago we had a young man who was from the Amish community who joined our congregation. And you know, at that time I really thought to myself, wow, this person left a congregation that was fully sanctified, fully doing these things, because he saw the truth in us. And it made me feel good, because like I said, they're living more sanctified than us, but this young man, even that he turned away because he knew that the things of Yahweh, you got to follow the truth. And it really made me have a lot of respect for that young man, you know, that he gave that stuff up because he was following the truth. And now I see, do we really got to make a choice? Can we follow the truth and still keep the sanctification? Is it a choice? You know? And it's something we need to look at as we're going forward here. Titus 2. Titus 2. In verse 1. He says, "But you speak things which become sound doctrine. Teach the older men to be temperate, sensible, pure, sound in faith, in love, in patience. Teach older women likewise to behave as becomes the worship of Elohim, not false accusers, not being enslaved by much wine, but to become teachers of good things, that they might train the young women to be modest, to love their husbands and their children, to be discreet, chaste, good homemakers, good, obedient to their own husbands, so that the word of Elohim may not be blasphemed. Likewise, exhort the children to be modest, holding forth yourself as a pattern of good works about all things in doctrine, in purity, sensibleness, in corruption. Choose sound words that are instructive, so that no man can point the finger of scorn at us, that he of opposition may be ashamed, having nothing bad to say about you." And like I said, they got the model of this. They're living this way. When you look at why they don't wear makeup, they don't wear jewelry, they wear, you know, pretty plain clothes, because they don't want their life to be filled with vanity. They don't want their life to be filled with vanity. They want their life to be filled with Yahweh. And these are things that we look at. Genesis 1, 26. We talked about this before. Elohim said, "Let us make man in our image, according to our likeness." Yahweh made us in his image, and now we have to grow in his likeness. And if we're going to grow in his likeness, you know, you got to look at the model that Yahweh put out there. It's not the model of the world, because it says, whoever is a friend of the world is an enemy of Yahweh. Every single thing out there today is just being magnified. It's satanic. It is the most satanic society we've ever seen, and it gets worse by the day. To think You know, and I'm not that old, I'm 53. But for me to think that I would live in a time where out there in society that it would be publicly accepted that it's just as good for a man to marry a man as to marry a woman, it is the most unnatural, perverted thing you could ever think of. There is no family. There's no family in history anywhere that you could look that two men are living together and have children. That is not our history of human beings. Never mind our history as believers. There's no model of that anywhere except Sodom and Gomorrah. It's only a model of destruction. It's a model of rebellion. And it's a terrible model. And that's the world we're living in. Everything of the model of the world is getting worse. It's getting worse. It's getting worse. And until the time that Satan will take his seat, unfortunately, not that far from here in Jerusalem for 42 months. And that's why now, that time is not that far down the road, and Yahweh is inspiring me big time. Get my people ready. We need to start working. We need to get ready. We can't wait for the last minute. We got to start making provisions because his kingdom is there. He's on his boat. He's on his way over. We need to be preparing, and we need to do it now. Leviticus 11:44 says, "For I am Yahweh your Elohim, and you have sanctified yourself, and you have become holy, for I am holy. And you shall not defile any persons with swarming things." So very clearly, I am Yahweh your Elohim, and you have sanctified yourself, and you have become holy, for I am holy. Yahweh is Kodesh, we need to be Kodesh. And we need to see, will we separate from this world, or will we be part of the world? This is the time that we have to look at every aspect of our life. And that's what makes community so great, because it makes it so easier for us. I know for myself, if I'm coming into the world like I did as an 18-year-old worldly kid when I came into the truth, if I didn't have a congregation there that was even semi-sanctified and separated, I would have never made it. I'd have nothing to compare it to. And I had people that were there that were living this way of life for 20, 30 years, elders that were there for 20, 30 years. And I wanted to exemplify them because I saw my way of life isn't working. I got to go to that way of life. And this is why communities, we can set these little communities and kingdoms up around the world as refugees in Israel, they had years back the cities of refuge, right? They had six of them, cities of refuge here. These will be little cities of refuge for Yahweh's people all over the earth. And as new people come into the faith, right? And here it is, that they're new and they're weak and they need strengthening. We could bring them into one of our cities of refuge. And it'll be a city away from Satan, that all over the world we could have these things in preparation for the kingdom of Yahweh. Because like I said, when the kingdom comes, you got to be ready to work from day one. Yeshua is not going to take the time of years to retrain us once the kingdom comes. That's what our life is for now. When that kingdom comes, we need to be ready to start from day one. 2 Corinthians 6:14. "Do not unite in marriage with unbelievers. For what partnership does righteousness have with lawlessness? And what fellowship does light have with darkness? And what agreement does the Messiah have with Satan? Or what part does a believer have with an unbeliever?" And it's not just marriage. This is marriage. It's anything that we're conforming with the world with, that he's telling us we need to separate. "And what harmony has the sanctuary of Elohim with idols? For you are the sanctuary of the living Elohim, as it is said, I will dwell in them and walk among them. And I will be their Elohim, and they will be my people. Because of this, come out from among them and be separated, says Yahweh, and do not touch the unclean thing, and I will receive you." Come out from among them and be separated. That's what we're doing. That's what the whole community thing is about. That from the head to the toe, it is sick now. Society is done. It's not turning in another direction. It's getting worse by the day. And if we don't start now, it's only going to make our life worse later. And what will happen is, if we don't do it together, it'll be impossible doing it separately. If we lose this opportunity now that Yahweh is giving us to do this as a people, when the time comes where the mark of the beast comes and society falls, you're going to be by yourself somewhere and you won't make it. You won't make it. So this is where we have a choice today. To be doing what Yahweh is leading, or to, again, reap what we sow later. Come out from among them and be separated. This is where Yahweh is leading. This is a direct command. And the only reason we wouldn't do it is if we love the world too much. Why wouldn't we do that? Why wouldn't we separate from evil unless we love the evil too much? And all the things that are there of the world, we really have to think, like I say, either you're influencing them or they're influencing you. And unfortunately, up to this part, we've been influenced more than they've been influenced. I don't see the world changing in our direction, but I do see us as a people taking too much of what the world is giving us. And this is the point where we need to put that line in the sand and say, enough. Enough. I'm doing it for me, but I'm doing it more for my family and the children, and I'm doing it for your children and your children. We have to do this for that generation. And like I said, think of the Qumran people. They had a philosophy. They had a theology. It was wrong, but this is what they believed and were convicted of. That when they went down to Qumran in 196 BC, they were believing the Messiah is not coming for 100 years. There has to be another 40 years in the wilderness. There has to be 20 years of the righteous priest. There has to be 40 years of war and wandering. So they're going, they're not thinking the Messiah is coming. We got to get ready. We're thinking it's happening soon, right? They're going thinking there's 100 years. Well, why go then? Why not wait 80 years and go? Because they knew the Messiah would not come unless there was a righteous generation that came up. So they went for their children and the grandchildren. But we're doing the same. We got to do it for our children and the grandchildren. Because remember, when Yeshua returns and we're made spirit being at his return, you know, those children we're raising now, and who knows, maybe our children will be old enough that they'll be part of the first fruits. Maybe it'll be our grandchildren. But there's going to be a young generation that will go into the kingdom as human beings, and they are going to be those first leaders physically in the kingdom. And our responsibility, it's a big responsibility just raising heirs for the kingdom. But to think now that we are the generation that will be raising those first youth in that kingdom is big. It's a great responsibility. But this is why we have to start doing it. 1 Thessalonians 4. 1 Thessalonians 4. Says, for the rest, my brothers, we beg you and exhort you in our Master Yeshua, even as you receive from us, how you ought to walk and to please Elohim, that you abound more. For you know what commands we gave you through the Master Yeshua. For this is the will of Elohim, your sanctification, that you abstain from fornication. For each one of you know how to possess his vessel in sanctification and honor, not in passion or lust, even as the nations do, not knowing Elohim. Nor to go beyond and overreach his brother in the matter, because the avenger concerning all these is Elohim, whom we foretold you, as we solemnly testified. For Yahweh did not call us to uncleanness, but toward holiness. Like he said, sanctification. He's calling us out of the world. He's calling us to be away from the world, not to be in the world, but not part of the world. And like I said, now we have that template. It's hard to conceive something when you don't know how to do it. But now we have a plan, and what my plan is to immediately start to put together a team of elders and leaders that we can start examining this. Because I'm not going to come back in one week in the next sermon and have an Amish hat and a little beard, you know, and have all the lights turned off. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there's something here for us to learn. But now, let's get a team, let's examine it, let's pray about it, let's even maybe have a worldwide fast about it, and let's see what we need to do from this point forward. But it's the time that we have to start looking ahead with these things. Romans 6 and verse 16, he says, do you not know that whom you present yourself as slaves to obedience, you are slaves to whom you obey, whether sin to death or obedience to righteousness, right? Are we a master or a slave? We're certainly not masters. If you think you're a master, you're kidding yourself. Because none of us are Elohim. None of us can give ourselves life and inherit. So we're all slaves. We just have free will to choose who we will enslave ourselves to. And you only have two choices. The Elohim of this world, Satan and his system, or the kingdom of Yahweh. Like we said, it's a mindset. It's living in that mindset every one of our days here. But thanks be to Yahweh that you were slaves to sin before, but you obeyed from the heart the form of doctrine, to now you have been delivered. And having been set free from sin, you were enslaved to righteousness. I speak as a man on account of the weakness of your flesh. For as you yielded your members as slaves to uncleanness, to iniquity, so now yield your members as slaves to righteousness, unto sanctification. For when you were slaves of sin, you were free to righteousness. Therefore, what fruit did you have in the things which you were ashamed? For the end of those things is death. But now, having been set free from sin and having been enslaved to Yahweh, you have fruit unto sanctification and the end of everlasting life. And I say, what fruit do you bore in the world anyway? Right? Working in the world, having all this torture in the world, did it make you a millionaire? Did it give you all the physical things you wanted? Did it give you peace in your heart? Are you happy? No, of course not. The world will never give you those things. Some of the most richest, successful people in this world, according to the world standard, like in Hollywood, are the most miserable people in the world. You know, they're the most miserable. They don't have good families or marriages. They're unhappy. You see a big thing of suicide being committed now by famous people because that way doesn't work. And Yahweh has freed us from that. And now, we can really have happiness in our lives because we need to do it according to the template. 2 Timothy 2, and verse 1. Then, my child, you be empowered by grace in Messiah Yeshua. And what things you heard from me through many witnesses, commit these things to faithful men, such as will be competent also to teach others. Then you suffer hardship as a good soldier of Yeshua Messiah. No one serving as a soldier entangles himself with the affairs of this life, so that he might please the ones having enlisted him, right? Are you a master and a slave? Are you pleasing your master? We're soldiers in the army, so you're not going out in somebody else's army. No one who serves as a soldier entangles himself with the affairs of this life, so he might please the one having enlisted him. And also, if anyone competes, he is not crowned unless he completes lawfully. It is right for the laboring farmer to partake first of the fruits. Consider what I say, for the Almighty will give you understanding in all these things, right? This is what we have to look for. We have to put all our goals and efforts to this. Jeremiah 6:16, so says Yahweh, stand by the ways and see, and ask for the old paths, where the good way is, and walk in it, and you shall find rest for your souls. And they said, we will not walk in it. And also I raised watchmen over you, saying, listen to the sound of the ram's horn. But they said, we will not listen. We know the world is like that. But Yahweh is saying, look for the old paths. One of the blessings we had when we were down there in the Amish community, they have a town there where they actually have a train, an old steam train from 1832. And we got to ride on that train, which was so neat. And they were telling us Abraham Lincoln actually rode on that train. It's the oldest train in America, steam train, still existing up today. And it was so neat to literally go back in time. Look for the old paths. That's what I said. The Amish, the Mennonites, they have that old path. They have the family values. They have it, and it's working. And we have to look for that old path. It's time to find the old path. 2 Corinthians 7 and verse 1, I think the last scripture I'll go over. It says, then having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all defilement of flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of Yahweh. So, like I say, we've come a long way in the wrong direction in this world, and not to our own being, just the way the world is. You know, like I said, there's many changes. You look from the beginning of this last generation in 1948, every generation has gotten more corrupt, more vile, you know, more immoral. The 50s, then the 40s, the 60s, then the 50s, the 70s, then the 60s. And here we are today. And we're at the tipping point. And I think this is why Yahweh is saying, you know, it's time that we pull in the other direction. It's time we start calling back. The Amish, they have this. They have the holiness. We need to investigate, like I said, with committees of elders on exactly what are the things we need to mirror and what they're doing and where Yahweh is leading his true believers. But like I said, in Jeremiah 12, it talks about if you can't run with the footmen, how will you run with the horses? And I have seen brethren from Western society in the last couple of years fall away, fall away, fall away. And the main reason is because of the thorns and the thistles, right? The cares of life, that the world is getting so bad
And if you don't sanctify yourself now, you're going to get swept up underneath it. And I say in every case, I've never met one person, I've never seen one case or heard of one case of somebody that has left the congregation, left the truth, that all of a sudden you hear about it 5 years later, that their life is great, they're happy, everything is better. It's the opposite. Their life is miserable, you know, their life is sad. We just heard of another person today, same kind of thing that happened, that actually wound up dying. So it usually happens. Suicide rate of people that leave the truth is extremely high because there's nowhere to go once you come to Mount Zion. And this is where we were saying that Yeshua came to give life and give it more abundantly. And he wants us to have full lives. And there's no shortcut. The way to do it is for us to follow that template, to build our communities around those core values that we have, to be there for each other, to help each other, to serve each other, and to be with each other. So I believe there'll be some major suggestions and changings coming as a congregation as we go through this year. Like I said, Yahweh moved us to the kibbutz communal mindset, but that was only in the beginning. And we see it. We can clearly see the things with the kibbutz that are not working, and we see the things that are working there. Like I said, the main thing is there's no sanctification that was there. We have to be fully sanctified if we're going to really make it to the wilderness. It worked for Qumran, you know. It worked for the Amish because they were fully convicted that what they were doing was 100% the right thing to do. We need to fully surrender to the will and the spirit of Yahweh to make it through the wilderness, as now that's the last step to the kingdom. And everything is a process. You know, you don't go, praise Yahweh. He doesn't expect us the day we're called or the day we're baptized to be completely changed. Life is a process. But during that process, we always have to be moving toward the kingdom of Yahweh. So I'm excited, really excited, because I see that this is going to change not only my family's life, but many of the believers around the world. And I can say that, I tell people with from the bottom of my heart, when I travel, the main thing I do besides giving the messages of the kingdom of Yahweh and the restoration, I tell the people about you. I tell the people about the other brethren. That's what I do. I go to places and I want to tell them about the brethren that are here and the brethren that are there, because I'm convicted by you. I hope I convict you with my messages, but you convict me with your lives. Because believe me, as I travel around the world, I see that there aren't people living this way. There aren't people as good as, like I said, the Amish are a template for family life and how to live. If I went to the Amish and was trying to share about Saturday or Sunday, they wouldn't listen. But we listen. We're willing to change. Our minds aren't closed. And that's why we're sitting in this chair. That if someone can show us from the Bible that we're wrong, we'll change with it. Because our convictions are based on those core values. But at the same rate, one of those core values is truth. And that's what makes us different. That we are willing to change. And that's what makes us the people of Yahweh. So it's exciting of the times we're living in and where we're going. But I'm really excited because the main thing with new people coming to the faith is they need a support system. And to see these, like I said, these cities of refuge, so to speak, be popping up around the world that we're calling, you know, our communities or our kibbutzes, it's just a great thing of Yahweh. So this is only the Philadelphian experiment has only just begun. Expect to hear a lot more about this. Yahweh bless. Shabbat Shalom.